Walden and Swanson spent hours with the Clinton lawyers and provided them with packages of documents covering the laws and procedures for selecting White House appointees, their term of employment, ethical considerations, security issues, and the clearance process. Among other things, these documents described in great detail how to vet an appointee so that the president could be protected from persons who could either embarrass the administration or endanger national security. Walden recalls that before the day ended, Nussbaum and Foster appeared in his doorway and introduced themselves. They explained that they had just finished a meeting in the West Wing with Deputy Counsel John Schmitz and Counsel to the President Boyden Gray. Nussbaum and Foster said that Counsel Gray had suggested that Walden was the person they should talk to in order to find out more about the mechanics of the ethics reviews and FBI background investigation process. Walden explained to Nussbaum and Foster that though he'd be happy to meet with them, he had just finished a lengthy meeting with Neuwirth and Mills on the same subjects and had given them extensive documentation, so they might want to touch base with their own lawyers first. Nussbaum and Foster thanked Walden and said that they would get together with Neuwirth and Mills. Walden also honored a request to meet with Kennedy and Mills and went over the same material again. Walden told me that he wasn't even a federal employee when he met with Kennedy on 16 February. He felt that he had already done his duty when he met with Neuwirth and Mills. He was on government time then. He was on his own time now. But Walden, just like the rest of the departing administration, had been ordered by President Bush to make this the best transition in the history of the White House. Not everyone was happy to help the Clintons, but nobody wanted to disappoint President Bush. So Walden went through it again. Staffing and presidential appointments weren't the only security risks at the Clinton White House. A related risk came from the new administration's total disregard for the security of classified information. Just as they ignored the need for FBI spin investigations, so too did they deride the idea of needing security clearances to handle or read classified documents. Emma Horton, an employee in the Office of Presidential Personnel headed by Bruce Lindsay, a close personal friend of the Clintons, was talking to me one day about classified material. She was a new Clinton staffer, not yet cleared by the FBI. I was curious. I asked her if classified material came across her desk. She would not answer directly. Instead, she asked, "What if I open it inadvertently?" Horton worked directly for Jan Piercy, an old associate and former classmate of Hillary Clinton's at Wellesley, and one of the hardest persons to interview that I ever encountered in the Clinton administration. Piercy simply would not return my calls. I finally complained to Lindsay about her, but nothing improved. Piercy's job at the White House was pre-vetting White House and executive branch candidates. Lindsay's and Piercy's office often received secret and top-secret material from the FBI and other agencies about some of the candidates under consideration. Presidential personnel needed to process the paperwork, but could not see the paperwork, except, of course, inadvertently. It took the Bush administration hundreds of employees with security clearances to handle the same volume of paperwork. But according to a GAO report made public in October 1995, from 20 January 1993 to March 1994, there were only 24 employees in the entire Clinton administration who had been cleared to handle the thousands and thousands of classified documents. There was no way they could have handled the workload. I believe that classified material passed through the hands of Clinton employees without security clearances. After all, little or no regard was given to any other security-related policy or procedure. Why would they treat classified documents any differently? Handling classified material without a clearance, or allowing classified material to pass through uncleared personnel, is a violation of federal law. But think of what it means for national security when just about anyone can handle classified material. It wouldn't take a KGB genius to infiltrate the Clinton administration. Apparently, most White House documents are freely available to whomever might look at them, however inadvertently. Early in 1993, while we struggled to understand the Clintons' hostility to normal security procedures, an incident occurred that shook up the Democratic National Committee, DNC, headquarters. An individual who was not a DNC employee, and who was suspected of being with the media, was caught inside the building, wandering around without an escort. Worse yet, this individual was observed trying to read a memo on someone's desk. David Wilhelm was reported to be very upset with this serious security breach. He immediately instructed all personnel of the DNC to apply for and get a pass and wear it at all times. DNC employees were reminded of the seriousness of the security breach and the potential damage that could occur if such a person had been able to read an important memo, one that might reveal some DNC political strategy, for example. So, down at the DNC, they understood the concept of security perfectly well. There was no confusion, no ambivalence, no hesitation to clamp down on security scofflaws. This incident drove the point home that the Clintons, their staff, and associates like David Wilhelm knew perfectly well what security was and why an organization should have it. The White House's security program was not a complex and mysterious operation beyond the grasp of the newly arrived administration, whose lawyers had been extensively briefed by Bush administration counsels. The Clinton administration knew how the system worked. And, as I would come to understand, they knew exactly what they were doing. Chapter 5. The Unraveling of Vince Foster. Rules for Radicals. A sense of humor enables him to maintain his perspective and see himself for what he really is, a bit of dust that burns for a fleeting second. A sense of humor is incompatible with the complete acceptance of any dogma, any religious, political, or economic prescription for salvation. George Washington's Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior. Do not express joy before one sick or in pain, for that contrary passion will aggravate his misery. I was looking forward to another meeting with Vince Foster. I had seen Foster from time to time after our meeting in February, but because the security program had been delegated down to Bill Kennedy and Craig Livingstone, I didn't see Foster as much as I would have liked. There were indeed plenty of security issues on which I needed the counsel office's assistance, but I had no intention of speaking to Kennedy about them. I had concluded that Kennedy was dishonest. In fact, after Travelgate, in which he'd gone around Dennis and me and abused the FBI, using us as political cover for the Clintons' pointless hounding of the travel office, I had no use for Kennedy at all. When I passed Foster in the hallways, or saw him under informal circumstances, he was invariably pleasant and friendly. We would stop and chat about generalities, but I did not make any effort to speak to him in such informal settings about my security concerns. I never noticed any evidence of depression, and if Foster was suffering, he hid it well. I believe I would have seen it if it was there. It was July 1993, and all the Clinton staffers were still walking around the White House with temporary passes, including Foster. In the Bush administration, a temporary pass was very easy to see because of the very large T on it in big, bold black print. Clinton's counsel's office and the Office of Administration changed that in a hurry. Instead of a big T that could easily be seen by the Secret Service, they modified the pass's design to a tiny T. This was how Nussbaum, Foster, Kennedy, and Watkins were able to get around the pass standoff with the Secret Service, who insisted it would not issue permanent passes to Clinton staffers until it was able to review the FBI background investigations in order to know which staffers might be a danger. But with the tiny T pass, staffers wandered the White House unrestricted, unless sharp-eyed Secret Service agents caught them where they weren't supposed to be. And given that so many Clinton staffers chose to wear no badges at all, Secret Service agents had their work cut out for them. I knew all this going into my meeting with Foster, and it weighed heavily on my mind. I had reached the conclusion that working at the Clinton White House could be dangerous. What could Foster do at this late date? I intended to address the issue of White House security with him, but at the same time I wondered if it might be only a fool's errand that would come to nothing and cause me a lot of trouble. How much power did Foster really have? Even though he exhibited an interest and some understanding of the need for security screening, I had to assume that Foster was bogged down with his work as Hillary's attorney, managing her blind trust and other legal affairs. I also suspected by this time that Bernie Nussbaum, or someone above him, had, for some reason, thrown sand into the works. What I could not understand was the enormous risks the counsel's office was willing to take by keeping the FBI reports out of the hands of the Secret Service. To be into the middle of summer of the administration's first year and have hundreds of staff members without permanent passes, and many without FBI background investigations, was, in my opinion, foolhardy. How could I know that Foster did not want the Secret Service to have access to his own FBI background check? Foster was one of the few who kept his appointments with the FBI. As I entered Foster's office, he rose to greet me, extending his hand with his usual warm, friendly smile. Again, I saw no sign of depression. He seemed upbeat, positive, happy. We quickly took care of the formal interview I had to conduct. Unlike most in the administration, Foster was known for his candor and openness. It made the process simple and painless. Then Foster turned to the question of security, as I had anticipated, and hoped that he would. How is security around here? Not good at all, Mr. Foster. What's the problem? If the FBI knew I were offering you my own opinions on the faults of White House security, it could cost me my assignment, or even my job. It's all right, Gary, this is just between you and me. You've got my word on that. Now tell me what the problems are. I told him the security process was still stalled, and that I was seriously worried about how the Secret Service had been blocked from seeing our reports. Blocked? Who blocked them? Well, Mr. Foster, it was the counsel's office. He seemed surprised to hear this. He asked about the magnitude of the character issues we discovered during our investigations. I told him they were numerous and serious. I also told him that I was not comfortable giving him information about any specific staff member. After all, many of these persons were his friends, and there were questions of protocol and discretion. Any negative comments from me about any specific individual could be misinterpreted or even misused. Foster should simply order copies of the FBI summaries, read the results, and judge for himself. There was a long-standing FBI policy that held that agents made no recommendations, offered no opinions. We were investigators, seekers of facts. We asked questions and made our reports. That's it. This was a new administration, and while I liked Foster, I did not trust him completely. Besides, it would have been improper of me to offer an opinion about any particular staffer, although several immediately came to mind. There was also an element of self-preservation in my reticence. If I had identified any one individual as being a security risk, as I understood the concept, and if that person turned out to be a good friend of the president, I would be a goner. At that time, I did not fully appreciate how many friends of Hillary staff members there were. Vince Foster was one of them. At what level of staff are you finding character problems? At the highest levels. He thought for a moment, appearing very troubled. "Are they using George?" he asked, referring to George Saunders. I suggested that he should speak directly to Saunders about that, not wanting to speak for George, but I indicated that he would get a negative response from him. "How about Kennedy? How's he doing with the program?" "Not so good," I replied. Foster now began to take notes. "What are the problems, the issues here, in your opinion? What do you think I should do?" "Well, Mr. Foster, I suppose that some of the senior staff are afraid that they will not be able to remain in the White House or get the necessary security clearances if the investigative results become known to the Secret Service. But this is a very dangerous and short-sighted approach." I became impassioned. I spoke of former presidents and how they had suffered from scandal, and how such scandals could have been easily avoided by a simple background check. I told him of many instances where the background checks were ignored, with disastrous consequences. I reminded Foster that it was one thing for an individual to lie to FBI agents. It was quite another situation for staff members to confess serious character problems and have the administration cover them up. I told him I thought that this was dangerous and stupid, because ultimately it was the president who would be held responsible for the failings of his staff, no matter how little he himself knew about them. I reminded Foster that presidents since Eisenhower had issued executive orders requiring background investigations, and they had also set forth minimum standards for employee suitability. It was simply unthinkable, incomprehensible, to abandon the security umbrella around the president, and yet the unthinkable had become reality. I told Foster that I could not stand by in silence and watch as the president or national security was placed in danger. It was my job, my mission, to see to it that the president was kept safe. I ended my speech by reiterating that Foster should call for the FBI investigations and review them himself. He indicated that he would. I thought that when he did, if he did, he would probably be in for quite a shock, thinking back to one case that I had called my litmus test. Months had gone by, time enough for someone to read the FBI summary, but that senior staffer was still working in the West Wing. But, ever the optimist, I still felt that the security program had been broken by ignorance, not willfully destroyed by someone with a sinister purpose. I thought they still had time to get things back on track. How wrong and naive I was. Foster continued his inquiry. Are all of the staff members in the West Wing required to have FBI security background investigations? What? Hadn't he been paying any attention to what I was telling him? With that question, Foster told me more than he could ever know. When he asked me if his own staff needed to be cleared with an FBI investigation, I realized just how deep the problem was. Foster did not have a clue. And no matter how much I lectured him, he still wouldn't have a clue. I answered that, yes, everyone needed to be investigated. They all needed clearances. I told him that during the previous administration, nobody was allowed to work in the West Wing until the FBI investigations were completed and reviewed and were found to be free of character problems. But this was crazy. Here was the deputy counsel to the President of the United States, and he didn't have the remotest idea of security procedures of the White House. If the counsel's office didn't know the whys and wherefores of security, who in this administration would? Foster changed the subject. He asked me about the status of the FBI, inquiring about morale and attitude. He wanted to know if I thought Bill Sessions, our FBI director, was being treated unfairly, having been left hanging for so long. Sessions was being investigated for allegedly misusing FBI assets and personnel, including using an FBI jet to carry firewood to Washington. A review of the allegations by Attorney General Reno was still underway, but months and months had gone by. The report wasn't that long, and the issues not that difficult to assess. Having a director in limbo was not good for the FBI. I told Foster that, and said if the director had misused FBI resources, I could not understand how he could stay in that position and remain an effective leader. On the other hand, I had no way of knowing whether the allegations were true. That was Attorney General Reno's job, and it was long past time for her to make a decision. I would be happy to know, Foster said, that the Sessions problem would soon be taken care of. I was amazed. Was Foster telling me that a decision to keep or fire the director of the FBI, my director, was imminent? Foster asked, "What do you think about appointing a younger man as director? How do you think the agents will react to that?" With that question, I was certain he was telling me that Sessions was a goner. I couldn't believe Foster would cross that line. Any doubts about what I thought he was trying to tell me were erased when he asked me about the most recent name floated by the administration to take Sessions' place, Judge Louis Free. I told Foster that my wife was a former FBI agent and had worked with Free and had a high opinion of him. He seemed pleased. Foster asked, "Do you think Free's youth will be acceptable to the older agents?" I told him the fact that Free was a graduate of the FBI Academy and had experience as an FBI agent would outweigh any age factor. In fact, a younger director might be just what the FBI needed. Foster thanked me for my time. He told me he was going to look into the security problems immediately and told me to call him if my concerns continued. As I left the counsel's office, I felt pretty good about our meeting, which had taken about an hour. But on another level, I was really concerned that Foster didn't seem to know anything about the concept of security. Also, the fact that Foster would brief me on what the White House intended to do about Sessions, and basically tell me that Judge Lewis Free was probably going to be the new director, proved he obviously did not understand Washington at all. After all, Sessions and the FBI higher-ups would very much have liked to have the information I had just been given. With one phone call, which I did not make, the entire Bureau would know Sessions' fate before he did. They would also know who the new director would probably be. Why couldn't these Clinton people learn the elementary principle of discretion? If I made that one call, it wouldn't be too long before such sensational news would be leaked to the media, and the White House would have yet another mess on its hands, as if there weren't enough messes. Was it possible that Foster wanted me to call FBI headquarters? I continued to wonder why Foster told me about Sessions. Did he really want my opinion, or was he just trying to keep me on the reservation by throwing me a prime tidbit? I drove home and had a quiet dinner with my wife and told her about Foster and his comments about Lewis Free. I put the fear of retribution out of my mind, believing that I had dumped the problem on Foster, right where it belonged. I arrived home by about 6:30 p.m. At about that same time, Vince Foster was joining his wife Lisa and other family members for dinner at a local restaurant. It was supposed to be a celebration. But Foster announced his intention to resign his position as deputy counsel to the president. His family members, however, talked him out of doing it, suggesting that things would get better. His wife, in fact, encouraged him to write down what was troubling him about his job, a list of grievances that was later found in Foster's briefcase, torn into 27 pieces. July 19, 1993 was a sad day for the FBI. Judge William Sessions became the first FBI director to be fired. It took two calls from President Clinton to convince Sessions that he should turn in his FBI property and leave the FBI headquarters building. Sessions left the FBI a disgraced and broken man, having failed to understand the group he was trying to direct and having failed to size up the nature of the persons who now ran the executive branch. All of his posturing to ingratiate himself with Janet Reno had done nothing to save him. On 20 July, Lewis Free was announced as President Clinton's choice for FBI director. That night, however, another of the Clintons' most important appointments met a different fate. I was watching President Clinton on the Larry King Show. Clinton had been on for an hour, and King asked him to continue for another half hour. He agreed, and they broke for commercial. During the break, somebody told Clinton that Vince Foster was dead. Clinton did not come back for the last half hour. Vince Foster's body was found in Fort Marcy Park, dead from a gunshot wound to the head, the victim of an apparent suicide. At 10 a.m. the next morning, I met a Secret Service buddy in the hallway of the OEOB. We were both in deep shock, not only because we knew Vince Foster, but because we understood the possible ramifications of his death. What if Foster had shot himself in his office? What if he'd first turned the gun on others? The fact was, the Secret Service had never examined Foster's FBI summary and had no idea what risks he might pose to himself or other staffers. I thought the security mess would hit the fan now, and we might be called in front of a congressional committee in a major battle between Congress, which had oversight responsibility, and the White House over the unconscionable and inexcusable risks that were being taken with the president's security. And I knew who would get the blame, the FBI and the Secret Service, not higher-ups and not the Bernard Nussbaums, who knew how to cover their tails. I also felt pangs of guilt. If Foster had indeed committed suicide, might I have unwittingly added to his woes with complaints about security, unsuitable staff members, and the potential for future embarrassments? At the time, I didn't fully appreciate that Foster was perhaps one of the biggest security problems that the White House had. Being a depressive with a gun, worried about his own ability to obtain and keep a security clearance and a permanent White House pass, and knowing that his deep involvement with the Clintons was about to be probed in painful detail by aggressive investigative reporters. Did he carry his gun into the complex or into the West Wing that morning? He could have. Was it in his briefcase? Had a suicidal man brought a gun into the White House with the intent to use it? It is precisely to prevent dangers like this that we have the FBI to conduct background investigations. A Secret Service, security fences, alarms, magnetometers, and access passes. All of these things are supposed to prevent the very kind of thing that Foster did. Who would have thought it possible for a high-level staff member and a close friend of the President and First Lady to commit such an act? Who needed to be in a position to predict and prevent it? The FBI and Secret Service, that's who. We will never really know why Foster did what he did, or where he did it. If we are to believe that he was deeply disturbed, deeply depressed, could he also have been angry at someone in the White House? Could Foster have been a danger to the President or the First Lady? The Secret Service agent asked me if I was aware that Foster's office had not yet been sealed. It was 10 a.m. the morning after the suicide. My astonished reply was, "What? You've got to be kidding me. The office should have been sealed immediately after the White House learned of Foster's death, to prevent any accidental or intentional tampering of evidence." It was a day of surprises. Later, I learned from media reports that the Park Service was going to be conducting the investigation of Foster's suicide. I was astounded. The FBI had never before taken a pass on such an investigation. Had the acting director, Floyd Clark, refused the case? And if so, why? The FBI had always been the agency of choice in previous administrations when there was a need for investigations of this kind. We were good enough to investigate the travel office staff on trumped-up charges of an allegedly missing $50,000, so why wasn't the FBI asked to investigate the death of the president's third-highest White House staff member? The Park Service is a fine organization, but it works under the supervision of the Secretary of the Interior, not the Justice Department. The Park Service has neither the depth nor the experience to investigate a case of this magnitude, unless, of course, the White House meant to limit the scope of the investigation. And I believe they did. The White House was like a morgue for about a week. Getting interviews with the Clinton staff had always been hard. Now it was impossible. We didn't even have Vince Foster to help us anymore. I got busy with administrative work and took care of my other FBI duties that were not related to the White House. A few days after Foster's suicide, my partner Dennis was crossing West Executive Drive on his way to the West Wing to conduct some interviews when he ran into Bill Kennedy. They stopped to talk, it being the first time they'd seen each other since Foster's death. Dennis described Kennedy as solemn, but then Kennedy always appeared to be in pain of some kind. Dennis offered his condolences, and they discussed the circumstances of Foster's death. Kennedy denied that Foster's White House tour or his new life in Washington had anything to do with his alleged suicide. Kennedy would know better than most about that. The travel office fiasco, where innocent permanent employees were persecuted because Hillary wanted an excuse to fire them and replace them with her friends, had been engineered by Kennedy and Watkins with Foster's acquiescence. As Rose Law Firm partners, Kennedy and Foster were also both deeply involved in the Whitewater mess, where it looked ever more likely the Clintons might be pinned as accomplices to what was essentially a bank robbery with a pen rather than a gun. If these matters had anything to do with Foster's death, Kennedy would know. He told Dennis they didn't. Vince brought his problems from Arkansas to the White House. It wasn't anything that happened here, Kennedy said. Then, on 11 August, Director of Security Craig Livingstone called me and asked me to meet him in the White House Counsel's security office. He sounded very mysterious, and he wouldn't tell me why he wanted to see me. As I walked down to the first floor of the OEOB, I wondered if I was going to be told anything about Foster and the suicide. Livingstone didn't indicate that I should bring notes of any particular case with me, so I knew our meeting was probably not about a routine background investigation matter. I thought I might be in for some interesting information, since Livingstone was extremely close to the Clintons. He would have known Foster and his family well. I hadn't talked to him since the funeral, but I knew he was deeply involved with monitoring the Foster investigation. Livingstone was my usual point of contact in the counsel's office, and we had become friends to the extent that it was possible under the circumstances. I thought then, and I think now, that Livingstone was really trying to do his best to protect the president. But he was an amateur, and he was getting no support from Kennedy. I also knew that Livingstone trusted me and took me for a serious, professional security man just trying to do his job. Livingstone motioned for me to follow him into the walk-in safe that was located within the security office. He told the staff to leave. Then he closed the thick steel door behind us so that we couldn't be heard. The walls and the door of this safe, which was also where the FBI reports are kept, are made out of solid metal and are about a foot thick. What he told me about Foster in that hour that we met inside that closed vault made the hair stand up on the back of my neck. I kept thinking all the time he was talking, "Why me, Lord?" Livingstone was clearly shaken by Foster's suicide and admitted it. He said, "Gary, I had to go to identify Foster's body with Bill Kennedy. It was terrible. Then we drove to Foster's townhouse in Georgetown to be with Mrs. Foster." "Craig, I feel terrible about this. I know how close you were to Vince. The entire White House seems to be in shock. The whole place seems to have shut down. But look, I have a confession of my own. I think I added to Foster's depression by telling him too much about my troubles on the job, and I feel awful about it." Craig seemed keenly interested in what I had just said. "What do you mean? How could you make Foster more depressed?" "No offense, Craig, but you know how I've been complaining about security. Well, I had a chance to talk to Vince on the 12th of February, and I took the opportunity to tell him how dangerous things are around here. He didn't have a clue. He was clearly shocked. I saw him again on July 9th, just 11 days before he killed himself, and I really let him have it. I told him the security here was a real mess, a significant problem. I figured you'd hear about that." "What did you tell him?" Livingstone asked. "Well, all the same things that you and I have discussed. He didn't know, for example, that there were hundreds of people walking around the White House, many through the West Wing, who had not had their security clearances completed. Foster didn't even know whether or not his own staff, right outside his office, should have a background investigation. He didn't know much of anything about the process. In fact, he knew so little, I didn't see how he could do his job. And then he asked me if there were any staff on board who shouldn't be allowed in the White House. I told him yes, there were many, too many. He asked me at what level, and I told him at the highest levels. I'm afraid I added to his woes by dumping all this on his lap." "Gary, I assure you none of that stuff had anything to do with his death. He had bigger problems on his mind. He was worrying that rumors about his affair with Hillary were resurfacing. We had that problem during the campaign, you know, after the business with Jennifer came up. You remember when Bill and Jennifer were doing their thing? Vince and Hillary were doing their thing. Vince thought if it surfaced, it would ruin his life, his reputation, and his marriage, and he thought it would impact big time on Hillary and the presidency. He was worried sick about it. What? An affair with Hillary? Livingstone looked genuinely surprised. You don't know? You're kidding me, right? I couldn't believe what he was saying. I remember that my hands were sweating. Why the hell was he telling me this? I had no business being in on this revelation. Craig went on. There are some people down in Little Rock who are talking about this and other stuff. We thought it was all put to bed, but it's resurfacing. So what? If it's not true, big deal. Those kinds of co-worker rumors happen all the time. Why would Foster kill himself over some rumor? Craig didn't answer. He just stared straight ahead, and in his non-answer, I believe he was telling me that he knew that the rumors were true. We sat there in silence while I thought of what to say next. I was very uncomfortable, and I tried to change the subject. All right, Craig, I don't know about all that, but the fact remains that the security system is broken, and now the only guy who seemed to give a damn about it, the only guy who could do anything about it, is dead. What do we do now? You think you're telling me something I don't know? I know it's a mess. It's all screwed up. The whole system's falling apart. He pointed to a stack of files immediately to his right. It was a high stack. He said, "See that stack of files over there? Each one is about a staffer who needs to be fired, right now, and I can't get Kennedy to do anything about it." I knew that nobody was being fired or otherwise affected by the FBI spins. Now Livingstone was admitting it. "You mean to tell me you've discussed these staffers with Kennedy? Does he know what the problems are? Does he understand?" "Oh, yeah, he knows. Not only that, he won't give me the budget or the manpower even to run this office." I knew that already. Craig had many more responsibilities than his predecessor, Jane Dannenhauer, and yet he was being paid about one half of what her salary had been. Jane ran a good shop, but she limited herself to flagging issues and sending the spins on to Deputy Counsel John Schmitz. Kennedy. Kennedy's not the right man for the job, Craig. For one thing, he takes nothing seriously, and for another, he's a snake. What do you mean, a snake? He's tried to set Dennis and me up, get us into trouble with our supervisor and the spin unit, so we'd be neutralized or transferred out. He's always trying to compromise us. Going to him with our problems is like the CIA going to the KGB. And then this travel office mess. That was abuse, Craig. He should never have forced the FBI to be involved in that sordid political game. At the mention of the travel office, Livingstone really got going. That effing Watkins? I told them that Watkins was going to screw everything up. Gary, I sat in a meeting when it was decided that the travel office guys were going to get fired, and that they would be reported to the FBI. I told them they were nuts. Look, we'd heard rumors that the press was taken care of by the travel office guys, bottles of wine in their rooms, easy customs exams, and stuff like that. But it was stupid of Watkins to suggest that the FBI be brought into it. There was no wrongdoing, no illegal acts that we could prove. The only good rumor we had was some reporter bringing in a carpet illegally through customs. That was it. I argued very strongly against bringing in the FBI. It was wrong. We unnecessarily ruined their reputations. It was Watkins and Kennedy, Gary. This was their big idea of how to get rid of them. I told them it was a stupid idea that would never work. What do you mean, you told them, Craig? This wasn't your department, was it? Look, Gary, I'm the security guy around here. Whatever happens regarding security, I'm in it, even if I don't decide. And even if I'm just told what to do, I'm still in the meetings. They know that I deal with the FBI all the time, so they would naturally want me to know what's going on. I've been in most of the meetings about security and the FBI. Your director calls me all the time. He knows me by my first name. I was dumbstruck. Craig, just what do you do related to security? Well, for one thing, I do a lot of the security advance for the president. Recently, I went with him to the Law Enforcement Memorial. Your director was there. I started to walk up to Louis Free, and your agents got all huffy about it. Craig was clearly annoyed that the FBI agents didn't know who he was. I said, "Hey, I'm Craig, and I'm a friend of your director. Back off." According to Craig, Free came over, said, "Hi, Craig, how you doing?" and signaled for the agents to back off. Craig went on, "I don't think I'll have this job very long anyway, but Bill Kennedy is effing up my chances to get anything good around here. He won't give me staff, he won't give me resources, he won't back me up on who we should fire. He's no help at all." I said, "Well, I'm not happy about what's going on here myself. I came here in 1990, found a good security program that works, and now I watch while the Clinton administration basically trashes it, disregards it. Why, Craig? Why don't you all just use the same system that's worked for 30 years?" "Gary, look, you just don't understand how things are here. It's me against Kennedy, and who are they going to believe?" "Maybe they won't believe you, but what if I backed you up? What if it was you and a senior experienced FBI agent saying it too? Don't you think they would listen?" "Yes, maybe so. Would you be willing to do that?" I admit I was caught up in the moment, sitting there in the vault with Livingstone, him confiding in me and giving me hope that I might have a serious ally to improve the security situation. I figured, what the hell? What have I got to lose? What are they going to do to a guy who is just saying, "Let's do a better job of protecting the President of the United States"? "Okay, sure, Craig, I'll do it. When do we talk to Nussbaum?" I didn't like the little guy, but maybe the two of us could get his attention. Craig looked at me like I didn't have a brain. "Nussbaum? It's not Nussbaum we gotta talk to. We'll be talking to Hillary." "What? You're kidding." "No. Look, Craig, I said I'd help you, but an FBI agent meeting with the First Lady? That's beyond me. Are you sure? I mean, this is my career. I have a family to take care of, a wife, 3 kids. What if she thinks I'm out of line? I mean, one word from her and I could be in serious trouble." "Hillary is the one to talk to, trust me. And I'll be talking to her tonight. I've got to join them on a trip on Air Force One. She'll understand the risk you're taking. You don't have to worry about her hurting your career. I know her well enough. She'll be interested to hear what you have to say. And she's the only one who can change things." I reluctantly agreed, thinking all the time that the great personal risk I was taking might be worth it. In hindsight, I was an idiot. It was naive of me to believe that Hillary Clinton gave a damn about me, or about calling me in to give my report, or about White House security at all. Of course, where does that leave Livingstone? To this day, I think he still believes she does give a damn. As I drove home that night, leaving a very emotional Livingstone and the White House in my rearview mirror, I felt like I was living a real-life spy novel, and I didn't care for it one bit. I was worried that Livingstone might have second thoughts about confiding in me. I was involved in a dangerous situation. If Livingstone ever confessed his extremely disloyal act of confiding in me to the Clintons, he would be fired. But my name would be mud. My FBI career would probably be over, and I might even be in danger if the stories coming from Little Rock were true, about how so many enemies of the Clintons ended up having fatal accidents. On Monday morning, and for several mornings after that, I waited for a call from Livingstone, ready to face my fate. The call never came, and Livingstone never mentioned the possible meeting to me again. I was just as glad he didn't. And there was something else to consider. I assumed this whole extraordinary interview took place because Livingstone needed to let off some steam, some pent-up emotions from the whole Vince Foster tragedy. But there was another possibility. The administration had Foster's notes, and it could have known of my conversation with him. Perhaps the interview was a way of finding out how much I knew. I doubted that possibility, but the fact that I even thought about it showed how worried I was. In February 1995, I was talking to a computer expert from the White House Information Resources Management Division about how I could clear deleted documents off my hard drive so that some computer thief wouldn't get access to classified material. Well, Gary, there are several ways a hard drive can be made unreadable. First, we can take the hard drive out and take it apart, actually break it into pieces. That's one very obvious way. Or I could take out the hard drive and just give it to you. You could then take it back to the FBI or do whatever with it, but you'd have to give me a new one to replace it, and a new one costs about $500. The FBI isn't about to give me $500 to solve this problem. I'm not sure that they'd know what to do with my old hard drive except throw it away. Well, Gary, there is also a government-approved scrub program we can use to erase the hard drive completely. When you're ready, call me, and I'll send a technician over. He'll put in the program, and in about 4 hours, the disk will be clean. We digressed a bit, talking about the Clintons, their staff, and what we had both witnessed over the past 2 years. Then he said, "Speaking of computers, have you heard about the Foster computer?" "What about it?" "You aren't going to believe what happened to it. Months after the suicide, someone finally got around to thinking about Foster's computer and ordered us to track it down. I can't believe that Fisk and your FBI boys didn't seize it right away, but they didn't. We tracked the computer by its serial number. We then ran a review of all repair and installation documents related to it, and guess what we found out? Foster's computer had been taken out of his office after his death because it wasn't being used, and someone else needed it. But when it was turned on, when someone tried to use it, it wouldn't boot up. The hard drive wouldn't function. A call was placed to the shop that repairs computers, and the guys came over to take a look at it. Sure enough, the hard drive wasn't operating. They took the machine apart and found the hard drive was so badly damaged it couldn't be repaired. The computer repairman didn't know the history of the computer, that it had been Foster's computer. So he simply took the old broken hard drive out and installed a brand new one. He programmed the new drive and took the old hard drive back to the shop and tossed it into the scrap barrel. A couple of months later, someone came along and emptied the scrap barrel. This is unbelievable. How could this happen? You do know that the FBI is investigating obstruction of justice charges in this case? Does anyone else know about this? Yeah, one of the guys testified about it to Kenneth Starr's group, or was interviewed about it, I don't know which. Staff knows about it, but I don't think anyone knows who did the hard drive. Did the hard drive? Wait a minute. Are you saying that the hard drive was destroyed by someone? How do you destroy a hard drive? Gary, there's only one way I know of to destroy a hard drive. You turn on the computer and order it to perform a function of some kind, and while the hard drive is working to finish the function, you pick up the case and you drop it sharply on the floor or on some other hard surface. The disk will usually self-destruct on impact, and then it can't be used and can't be read easily, if at all. Of course, even if we could read it, it's long gone now because all those investigators didn't think to ask about it. This is crazy. Why didn't they seize the computer as evidence? They should have done that first thing. Gary, I've known you for years, and you know I like the FBI, and I think you're an excellent FBI agent. So please don't be offended by what I'm about to say about your FBI. Everyone around here is asking the same thing. How could the FBI agents assigned to this case be so stupid as to miss something this basic? Don't blame the FBI. We get blamed for everything, but when we work for a special prosecutor, there isn't much we're able to do on our own. There isn't any real independence. Look, when there's a case like this, the prosecutors go into micromanagement overdrive. They're absolutely terrified that the FBI agents working for them will make a mistake if they're not micromanaged, or that the FBI will think of something that they haven't thought of first, something that'll take away from their moment in the spotlight. It's not like you think at all. We don't run these investigations. We take orders. FBI agents working for an independent counsel have virtually no say in what is done or not done. It hurts our ego to admit it, but it's true. The good old days of the independent FBI are over. The FBI gets the blame, and the prosecutors get the credit. That's how it works these days. Well, then the prosecutors really blew it. If we all know they should have seized the computer, why didn't they? Chapter 6. Good morning, Mrs. President. Rules for Radicals. The 11th rule of the ethics of means and ends is that goals must be phrased in general terms, like liberty, equality, fraternity, of the common welfare, pursuit of happiness, or bread and peace. George Washington's rules of civility and decent behavior. In your apparel, be modest and endeavor to accommodate nature. Rather than to procure admiration, keep to the fashion of your equals, such as are civil and orderly with respect to times and places. On 2 February 1996, the President of the United States attended an annual rite, the National Prayer Breakfast at the Washington Hilton. The media reported attendance of about 1,000 of the most powerful persons in government and business. In what had to be one of the most unlikely stand-ins in modern times, U.S. Senator Carol Mosley Brown, a person who has been accused of numerous financial wrongdoings, including stealing from her own mother, spoke in place of the Reverend Billy Graham, who was too ill to attend. Senator Brown began her remarks by acknowledging the presence of the President and Mrs. President. If ever there was a slip that could be called Freudian, that was it. Maybe God spoke through Brown that morning to make sure the rest of the country knew what was going on in Washington, that we had traded in our Constitution for a new bizarre experiment in the executive branch, a co-presidency. Early in the Clinton administration, the media was full of stories about FOBs, Friends of Bill. But many of the appointees I investigated were really FOHs, Friends of Hillary. Nowhere were her thumbprints more pronounced than on the Health Care Task Force, the most important domestic project of President Clinton's first term. The health care debate looked very different inside the White House than it did to the public. While the public was inundated by hard luck stories of suffering poor people who had lost their insurance, the Clintons themselves were behaving like the most cutthroat corporate downsizers. In an effort to make good on candidate Clinton's promise to cut the White House staff by 25%, a target the administration never reached, many longtime federal employees were fired. To staff the White House, the administration brought in a flood of interns and volunteers who worked not only without insurance but also without pay and frequently without professional standards of behavior. Kept very quiet by the Clintons was the fact that many White House employees were hired as officially part-time staff to be paid at only 39 hours a week or less, even though there was plenty of work for them to do and they wanted to work full-time. But denying them that extra hour of work a week allowed the White House to deny them a variety of benefits, the chief of which was health insurance. During the health care crisis, a friend of mine named Karen, who had worked in Bush's visitor's office, called to see how I was doing in the new administration. "Oh, pretty good, Karen. You know the usual grief that comes with presidential transitions, but we'll work through it. How about you?" Karen told me she had joined a U.S. Senate campaign, and if her candidate won, she might take a job in his Washington office. "Congratulations. Good luck. I hope he wins." "Thanks, Gary, but I'm calling for another reason. I want to know what the heck is going on with Hillary Clinton." I wasn't sure what she meant. "I have a friend up here who just returned from a conference at the White House, and if what she tells me is true, Hillary must be really wacky." "Like what?" "Well, three health insurance company executives hired my lobbyist friend to go with them to the White House to present their solution for the health care crisis. They wanted personally to present their case to the task force, hopefully directly to Hillary. They got their chance. They were able to get an appointment with the First Lady. They went down there in a group, were brought into the West Wing, and were told to wait in the Roosevelt Room. They had sent advance copies of their plan, and they were looking forward to speaking to Hillary about it." "How did your friend get caught up in this?" "Well, she's the sister of a classmate of Hillary, and it was thought that if a call was made, you know the rest, right?" "Yes, so tell me what happened." They were kept waiting an hour. Then Hillary walked in, slammed their proposal on the table, and said, "Gentlemen, I have looked at your proposal, and it's pure bull. Now you've had your meeting. Get out. So my friend, who was really humiliated and very angry, got up from her chair, looked Hillary square in the eye, and said, "Mrs. Clinton, my sister warned me